In Chapter 6 of From a Limestone Ledge, John Graves writes about the throwaway economy which morphed from the forced frugality of the 1930s. He referred to Americans buying Thunderbirds which they didn't need with money they didn't have. We continue. In recent years, of course, doubt has replaced a good many people's righteous glow as the price of the gallon of gas that will propel a T-Bird about 9 or 10 miles down the pike has edged up past a dollar toward God knows what stopping place. Erstwhile desert raiders grow richer than very rich Texans. Heat sometimes fails to gush from heating ducts. Rivers and even breezes smell bad. And fish sticks arrive at table impregnated with tasty carcinogens. Our tenure in Sinless Eden begins to seem less assured, and here and there among the fruit trees stand prophets calling themselves environmentalists, ecologists, post-industrialists, and other things, who assert loudly that there really is guilt after all. They cry out these spoil sports for a return to the thriftiness on a grand scale, for husbandry of resources, for scrimping and patching and saving, for salvage and reuse, which in current profit language are known as recycling. Well and good, an aging, rustic observer thinks. Very well and very good, in fact, and high time it is for such ideas to grab a hold. But in his innocent mind there's a glimmer of the déjà vu. He puzzles this peasant naïf over whether there's really much difference between these rather modish activities mobilized beneath the banner of ecology and a lot of ancient practices and attitudes that have limped along with our species through the centuries under a crude, tattered ensign labeled need. Men have always rejoiced in extravagance when luck permitted, from primitive yahoos harrying entire herds of bison over a cliff for the sake of a few steaks and chops, to modern suburbanites generating X pounds of rich garbage per head per day and vacationing in Las Vegas. But that sort of luck has been rare, and the salient economic traits of the bulk of humankind throughout history have been thrift and stingy inventiveness, which still rule supreme across most of the Earth's curving crust. What, he wonders, our old déjà viewer, is whether the present uproar doesn't just mean that the tortoise is catching up with the hare, that some age-old gritty facts of life are getting ready to reassert themselves against the prodigal way of being that a few Western nations have been able for a time to afford. For in rural regions of even the Western world, those facts have never sunk beneath the surface of things. At rare and uncertain intervals, farmers and graziers have managed to gather a little of boom's largesse along with their city cousins, but more normally, they've had to watch from afar, wistfully, or at times with rage, the major harvest of cash and its attendant fun and games. While most care enough for their life on the land to stick it out there if they're able, large numbers of them, especially among the small-timers, have been forced to leave by an inability to pay for the high-priced goods and equipment they either need or have been seduced into buying, and often also by the rebelliousness of wives and offspring who find the antiseptic and pleasure-filled world they see on TV preferable to the labors, stinks, and simplicities that a country existence traditionally entails. Survivors, therefore, are likely to be types who have chosen sturdy mates and are willing to work at outside jobs when country income dwindles. They also have a high resistance to the charm of expensive shiny machines and gadgets, and above all, they're imbued with the old rural instinct and ability to patch and salvage and improvise and substitute whenever possible instead of buying. Frugality has never gone out of style for them. They wear it like a much-darned sweater. Nowhere is this more apparent than in marginally productive country like these rocky cedar hills where I live, and in no way is it better shown than in the hill dwellers' prevalent attitude toward materials that an industrial society gone mad regards as trash, waste, junk. What much trash amounts to around here is a potential defense against the demons of a hostile economy. It serves not only to repair one's machines and other possessions and to keep them usable, but also to fabricate new ones. One or another kind of it fits into tractors, implements, buildings, plumbing systems, fences, feeders, or elsewhere. And if it doesn't fit anywhere, it probably has some wondrous new country usefulness of its own, just waiting to be discovered. Hence the durable forms of it are seldom treated with the contempt they get in cities, where they're tossed out to be whisked away by municipal employees for destruction or burial at distant sites, but are saved, often cherished, and given new purpose when occasion permits. In truth, it seems sometimes that the ability to amass junk, and to use it ingeniously, is a measure of true countryness, not only among natives, but among part-timers like me, and even some of the well-heeled city people who, for a good many years, have been buying and fixing up old homestead tracts in our hills, at first for weekend pleasures, and then, as fascination progresses, for use as stock farms or little ranches. With these latter, the use of trash may begin as an amusing way to emulate local picturesqueness, old tractor seats made into patio stools and so on, but it generally gets more earnest as they discover what a fathomless pit of expenditure the improvement and working on a country place can be, unless you learn to cut corners. And when they start being proud of their junk like the rest of us, they're snared for good. I lately examined a fine cordwood splitter designed and constructed by a friend of mine. Among its components were a 5-horse air-cooled engine from a wrecked lawnmower, a Case tractor's hydraulic pump, a long-stroke piston out of the landing gear of a World War II bomber, 2 lengths of railroad track, a massive riving wedge made from old plowshares welded together, and various other hunks of metal gleaned with a cutting torch or a wrench from car frames and elsewhere. Such mechanical complexity is beyond my own modest powers, but I found it admirable, just as its maker understands my pride in more rudimentary creations, like water troughs fashioned from the galvanized drums of big cable spools, and an efficient grape crusher with rollers made out of lengths of leftover plastic sewer pipe, some pulleys and bearings from a worn-out washing machine, and a handle off a busted meat grinder. Bomber parts and cable spools and railroad iron are obviously not typical run-of-the-mill rural refuse. Neither are cross ties, public urinals, car drive shafts and axles and engine blocks, used telephone poles, oil field sucker rods and drill stem pipe, anchor chains, highline brace cables and earth screws and eye bolts, howitzer wheels, fire escape ladders, street paving bricks, signboards, janitor's sinks, steel barrels, landing mats, and a good many other sorts of technological detritus that find their last, sometimes bizarre employment out here among us hayseed inheritors. With them, we supplement our local sources of trash, which are often meager precisely because of all the indigenous frugality and the repair skills that keep things functioning practically forever. We find them in the automotive cemeteries, junk and wrecking yards, war surplus emporia, and other cluttered trash havens of the cities, where so much discarded treasure finds a resting place. On trips to town, we may browse for hours in favorite establishments of this sort, like bookworms on the quays of Paris, emerging most often with a few irresistible artifacts in the beds of our pickups, acquired for a pittance, and perhaps not even needed now, but far too good to pass up. Without this copious fountainhead of exotic refuse, I'm sure we would feel deprived, as some apolitical Korean and Vietnamese peasants, crafty junk utilizers, both breeds, must have felt when the prodigious flow of GI waste slacked off in their respective lands. Maybe we would form our own cargo cults, as certain Melanesian tribesmen have done in hazed recollection of war's richness, awaiting with drums and prayer and a rattling of boar tusk bracelets the airborne return of the lavish alien god John Frum. Singing my song of trash, I sense the onset of shudders in more aesthetic readers who may recall country dooryards where defunct cars and appliances and large objects of rusty iron vied with lilac bushes and shade trees and views of distant hills for an observer's attention, and who conclude that such scenes must be the inevitable effect of fascination with junk. It is not so. True, some collectors do get thinking that their prizes are pretty all by themselves, but their wives seldom share that belief, and most country junk awaits its time of resurrection in repositories out of sight of the house. My own supply, for instance, is divided between an area behind the barn where heavy or valuable things molder in dignity, and our household dump in a stabilized gully across the creek, where more portable and ordinary pieces rear up out of a sea of cans and glass and plastic and crumpled baling wire. Shamefully and unecologically, we burn most paper and such, though organic kitchen waste goes into the garden to be plowed under like manure. But it's there if I ever want it. And even if I can't always find a needed item by delving into my own assortment, I can often cadge one or trade for it, the swap being another prime element in rural thrift, from out of a neighbor's hoard. As for the deliberate decorative use of junk qua junk, once common in the Texas landscape, it's fallen off sadly in recent decades as homogenized electronic sophistication has infiltrated people's consciousness. I refer to such things as yard fences made from dummy practice bombs, or landing mats, or bed springs, or cultivator wheels, and flower beds ringed with old truck or tractor tires painted red, white, and blue. Examples of this kind of work are rare enough now that I get a nostalgic twinge from their sight, and though I know very well that a current vogue in the use of native natural materials like cedar poles and limestone is in far better taste, I still sometimes find myself missing certain striking monuments to some junk lover's conviction that trash is glorious stuff. One of these was the home of an obviously vigorous and probably Rabelaisian family in a small central Texas town I used to pass through on trips. At the perimeter of its lot was a 10-foot levee of tamped, sodded earth, on top of which they had embedded a parapet of old stoves, refrigerators, washing machines, and toilet bowls, these last being filled with artificial flowers. It was something to look forward to, but my last time through I saw they had moved away and a Philistine new owner had their fortress razed flat with a bulldozer. Those of the rest of us who let our affair with refuse escape from the realm of its usefulness mainly manage now to confine the visible result to a knick-knack shelf or two, full of old cough syrup bottles, rusty spurs, harness buckles, fragments of Model T Fords, shed deer antlers, and other such delights found here and there on our property. But there's always the danger the thing can get out of hand. Not long ago, after planting my little French hybrid vineyard, I started looking ahead to its time of fruitfulness and told a few city friends of gourmet bent that I'd appreciate their saving wine bottles for me. They did so, with a vengeance, and at present their response lies several layers deep in a small separate shack we call the bunkhouse and has invaded a side room of our home. The accumulation is causing uneasiness in the family's senior female, but as for me, I find all these jewel-like, flat-bottomed bubbles of glass exquisite, quite aside from their intended purpose. I soak off their labels, wash them till they gleam and glitter, dry them upside down on a rack, plug their mouths with tissue against dust and web-weaving spiderlets, and then sort them according to hue and shape, burgundy, claret, Rhine or Italianate oddball, before storing them away in compartmented cartons liberated from a liquor store's garbage. As the stacks of cartons grow, I find myself gloating over them, and only now and then do I wonder idly who it is far back in the mists of my youth that I remind myself of. And we come now to Chapter 7, which John Graves has entitled Kindred Spirits. I have what started out as a canvas-covered wooden canoe, though with the years it's taken on some aluminum in the form of splinting along three or four fractured ribs, and this past spring I replaced its rotting cloth rind with resin-impregnated fiberglass. It is thus no longer the purely organic piece of handicraft that emerged from a workshop in Maine some decades back, nor do I use it more than occasionally these days, to run a day's stretch of pretty river or just get to where the fish may be. Nevertheless, I retain much fondness for it as a relic of a younger, looser, less subtle time of life. While readying its hull for the fiberglass, I had to go over it inch by inch as it sat on sawhorses in the barn, removing the mahogany outwales and stripping off the old canvas, locating unevenness in the surface of the thin cedar planking, sanding and filling and sanding again so that the protuberances and pits would not mar the new shell or lessen its adhesion, and finally taking out the seats and thwarts and readying the interior for fresh varnish. That process took up a good bit of my spare time for weeks, and during it I got to know a couple of Indians fairly well. At least I thought of them as Indians, for the canoe company which takes its name from the old town of the Penobscots used to employ many of that tribe's members as workers, and for all I know still does. There was the Good Indian, as I came to call him, who had stood on the left side of the craft while it was being built. Port and starboard will not serve, for the thing had lain sometimes right side up on its trestle or table or whatever held it, and sometimes upside down. Selecting and trimming his planks with care and affixing them to the ribs so that their edges and butts fitted tightly, and the tacks were driven precisely flush, drilling his screw and bolt holes true. And across from him on the right side had labored his confrere Slovenly Pete, a brooder and a swigger of strong waters during the long Maine winter nights, who, with reddened eye and palsied hand, had messed up everything he could without getting fired from his job. Their ghosts were with me, and I spoke to them as I went over their work and did my own. The Good Indian was a friend, a taciturn perfectionist in sympathy with my resolve to get things right. But somehow I took more interest in his shiftless mate, a sour and gabby type who responded to my jibes about hammer marks and ill-matched planks and protruding tack heads with irrelevant rhetoric on white man's viperish ways or biting inquiries as to what business a Texan had fretting over a canoe in the first place. "Your goddamn rivers," he said at one point, "ain't got no goddamn water in them most of the goddamn time." I've been in this sort of touch with many artisans and laborers over the year, for I am both a putterer and a countryman, categories of humanity that frequently busy themselves in refurbishing and repairing things that other human beings have made or refurbished or repaired in times gone by, leaving personal imprints on them. An old Ford tractor, for example, whose hydraulic pump was replaced by a previous owner with a second one from another model, by dint of much ingenious grinding and shimming and drilling, can cause one to ponder and blaspheme for days over the question of why the costly new pump he has driven 50 miles to buy at a dealership can't be seated. And if, when starting casually to pull out a decayed 40-year-old fence corner post set 4 feet deep in order to put a new one in its place, you discover that whoever installed it was such a fence nut that he filled the hole around it with angular crushed road gravel tamped down to grip it like death. Your emotions are mixed as you strive without success to budge his monument with a tractor drawbar or a jack rated at 5,000 pounds lift. On the one hand, you have to admire the uncompromising correctness that made him go to such trouble. On the other, more strongly, you wish that in the matter of fence strength he had been a bit more of a slob like yourself. Sweatily romantic couples who have redone, maybe rebuilt old houses with their own hands, ripping out ancient wallpaper and linoleum and pipes and wiring and such, searching out pockets of dry rot and settled foundation piers and chimney cracks, working everything down to bare wood and masonry or beyond, nearly always arrive at intimacy with their predecessors in those abodes, their Good Indians and Slovenly Petes. Nearly always, too, they find the villains more interesting than the nice guys. It is, of course, most pleasant to learn that underneath some tech-stone plasterboard and 8 or 10 layers of bargain basement latex paint and wallpaper and white lead and alligator varnish and the like, You're the owner of a room paneled in wave grain solid black walnut, beautifully fitted and joined, or that above the rusty stamped tin ceilings of a Stone Hill country cabin are beams of native post oak hewn square with an adze by some ancestral Deutscher. But it's probably a bit more fascinating to discover, as a friend of mine did, that the faint stink which has seeped in for years from a north kitchen wall and has lately grown too stout to ignore derives from the grassroots inventive genius of an anonymous farmer occupant who insulated that wall by filling its stud spaces with cottonseed hulls, fermented now by a siding leak into rich and miasmic silage. One has to face also, from time to time, some effect or the other of the powerful belief among prairie Gothic carpenters of a more innocent era that a 2x4 would serve for just about any purpose. I've seen whole upper floors sustained by joists of those dimensions, a bit concave and springy underfoot, but still functional, and in one antiquated farmhouse that my wife and I rented cheaply for several years because we were willing to refinish it ourselves, I traced some mysterious cracks and sags to a small bracket built out of 5 or 6 short lengths of 2x4 yellow pine, nailed halfway up the wall of a closet and sheathed in shiplap. It held up an entire brick wood stove flue that must have weighed, according to my rough computation, about 4,500 pounds. I had strange feelings about that chimney and the ghost who had put it there, and I hoped that whenever it fell it would choose to collapse straight down toward where its foundation ought to have been, rather than topple sideways through the attic and ceiling onto the bed where gentle sleep enveloped us, or at the table where we are. But now, 9 years after we moved out of that house, and maybe 60 or 70 after the chimney was erected, I note with interest that whenever I drive along that road, it's still poking up quite vertically above the roof line. And in fact, wintertime wisps of smoke tell me that a current tenant, enamored of alternative energy, has hooked up a wood stove to it again. Living now on this place we've owned for 2 decades, where I've built all the structures, sometimes with help, but often not, the ghost I most usually have to confront is myself. A chimney that leaks in its flashings, an outbuilding set up on blocks of wood through which termites have made a gleeful invasion, a sheet-iron barn roof that siphons rainwater at some seams when certain winds are blowing, a crawl space inundated by storms through the place where the water pipes enter, all these joys and others are traceable not to the faulty theories or sloppiness of old-time carpenters and masons, but to my own apprentice ignorance. An owner-builder lives with his botches, and working to correct them he waxes introspective, not necessarily with admiration. I seldom work up the guts for that ultimate form of puttering which involves the patching or restoration of good antique furniture and other classic artifacts. Stout, relatively crude country-made relics, whose charm is in their honesty and in the sheen of long, hard use, I will tackle willingly enough, for the crude, stout, honest repairs that befit them are within my capacity, and their native woods and other materials are usually easy to match. But it takes naivete or a special sort of arrogance to tamper with the civilized products of vanished masters' vanished dexterity with hand tools. Their aged and chip-prone hardwoods, harvested perhaps in distant forests of the old British Empire, where tigers burned bright and white men carried metaphoric burdens and dark men a literal burden, are very hard to duplicate with inserts or patches made from woods available now. Furthermore, the powered machines on which most present woodworkers depend won't reproduce the contours of their moldings and furbelows, and authenticity prohibits the use of epoxies and other miracle fillers and cements, mainstay substances in modern repair. Bungled work can lower their often considerable value, so like most other people, I'm usually willing to leave restoration to professionals or to let the wounded things sit in their corners as is. Spirits inhabit them too, of course, those of their gifted makers in the individual organic perfection of their shaping and joining and decoration, those of intermediate slovenly peats in crude repair jobs undertaken at some point in their history and showing up now as an ill-seated reinforcement block and screwdriver nicks and other defects. And if one does let arrogance tempt him into essaying such a job himself, as I have on rare occasions, more often than not he ends up leaving a slovenly peat spore also, or else giving up the middle and either abandoning the object in question in a dismantled state, or letting someone else puzzle it back together. Sometimes, with a flush of guilt, I run across envelopes or cartons with labels on them in my own handwriting, such as Trim from Dressing Room Bureau, or Pieces of Rosewood Snuff Box. That latter project hit a dead end some 11 years ago when I was unable to find any nickel silver of the right thickness for making new delicate hinges to replace broken ones, and then it got forgotten in a round of very different puttering, the framing of a barn. I do still intend to seek out that metal and finish up the job, though, maybe in tremulous old age, when my chances of being a slovenly peat will be even better than now. Next time on The Bookshelf, we'll find out how, for author John Graves, the art of puttering morphed into a habit of hoarding. Be sure and join us for more of Graves' delightful essays on his life in ruraldom in his book From a Limestone Ledge, published by the University of Texas Press. Vern Windham is executive producer of The Bookshelf. I'm Tom Bacon.